Tonight on the program, we are talking about a subject that most of us want more of, few of us are getting enough of, and something that can have a bigger impact on our health and well-being than most of us realize. That topic is sleep. According to the Center for Disease Control, adults need at least 7 hours of shut-eye per night on average, but more than a third of American adults are simply not sleeping enough. We've heard that. We've heard lots of people talking about this, but tonight we're going to be taking a little bit deeper look at that. And it's no wonder we're not sleeping well, right? In our contemporary world of hyperconnectivity, corporate golden handcuffs that keep us working longer and longer hours, 24-hour news cycles, screens, fret about world events, and that impact that screens are having on our circadian rhythms, and then add in workplace and family demands, it is no surprise at all that we are not getting the rest that we so desperately need. But not getting enough sleep is pretty literally killing us, with the medical community drawing very short lines between lack of sleep with depression, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and stroke. According to the International Journal of Occupational Medicine and Environmental Health, even 24 hours of sleep deprivation is on par with the cognitive impairment of having a blood alcohol content of 0.10%, which is more than the legal limit for driving. Then, at 36 hours of sleep deprivation, high levels of inflammation start to show up in the bloodstream, which over time can lead to heart disease and high blood pressure and a whole slew of other things. And that is just the physical. Look for the psychological effects of sleep deprivation, and even cursory research quickly points to impaired memory and attention spans, lack of attention to detail, problem-solving skills, reduced ability to reason, and triggers for mental health conditions. Not to mention that in simplest terms, sleepy brains just have to work harder than well-rested ones. Also, according to a 2013 collaboration of very, very smart sleep researchers, when we conk out asleep, the brain doesn't just switch off, but instead a series of very highly orchestrated things occur in the body, allowing the brain to reset, to store memories, and to clean out all the extraneous toxins and other junk that builds up in our brains during waking hours. It's like taking out the trash and putting away the dishes. No sleep? Well, that brain junk is going to pile up. And I don't think any of us want that. So tonight, we'll look at why we should take sleep far more seriously than we do, why we should pay more attention to making sure we get plenty of quality sleep, and why. And we'll look at some of the more curious things that our brains do while we're sleeping. And we'll take a look at attitudes held around the world about sleep and throughout history. I'm Amy Guth, and that is all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. You heard the woman. I'm Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your time with me on Saturday evenings. Well, tonight on the program, we are talking about sleep, how we think about it, why and how we struggle with it, from insomnia to sleepwalking to sleep paralysis, and why we need to really make some shifts so that we can sleep as much as we can. I know we hear that a lot. You know, we all kind of know anecdotally that not getting enough sleep is bad for us. Let me tell you what, getting ready for this show tonight and talking with these experts that we're going to be talking to here in just a bit and reading about the work that they're doing, it's really, really quite shocking. It's much more more severe than perhaps we realize what is happening to our bodies and why we so desperately need sleep and what happens when we don't get enough of it. So we'll be joined tonight by a University of Illinois professor and director of the school's Sleep Science Center, Dr. Bharati Prasad, to talk about the physical processes that are at work when we're sleeping, particularly in our brains. That is the really, really very fascinating process there. We're also going to talk with Dr. Melissa Melby about sleep practices around the world, because sleep is not sleep everywhere you go. There's some really interesting nuances to how we sleep in different parts of the world and how we have slept over time. So we're going to be looking at that. And we're going to talk with filmmaker Rodney Asher about the film both Vulture and IndieWire writers described as one of the most terrifying they'd ever seen. And yet, it is not a horror film. It is a documentary. It is a documentary about sleep paralysis. So we're going to be talking with that filmmaker. And as ever, we have a lot to do and a lot to talk about. And we certainly want to make sure that we give our very, very wise guests lots of room to share their knowledge with us. But of course, we will be taking calls 312-981-7200. If you have a question about sleep or you want to share some sleep habit or a trick you learned, something like that, we would love to hear from you. Again, that's 312-981-7200. Esteemed producer Tom Hush will be the voice on the other end of the line when you call. You can also text that number, or if you're feeling a little shy, don't want to do that, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H. I'm on all those platforms. You can find me there, and especially Twitter. You can always play along during the show, and I'll always read tweets that are clean enough and friendly enough for radio. So we'll be right back to get this show underway here on 720 WGN. All right, we are talking all about sleep tonight, and we're talking about many different aspects of it. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bharati Prasad, who is the director of the Sleep Science Center at University of Illinois, and we're going to be talking about the kind of the physical processes with sleep and all that goes along with that. And then we're going to be talking about with Dr. Melissa Melby, who's an assistant professor at the University of Delaware, who specializes in, this is such an interesting specialization, very, very specific, specializes in sleep practices around the world, which I think is so very interesting. We're going to be talking with her. And then a little bit later, we're talking with documentary filmmaker Rodney Asher, who made a film called The Nightmare that's all about sleep paralysis. And I've got to tell you, that film is like, it feels like a horror movie, but in fact, it is a documentary about people that are suffering from sleep paralysis and really, really scary things. But it's beautifully shot and it's a really interesting subject. So it's all these different aspects of sleep tonight. And, you know, it's one of those topics, right, that we start peeling away at. It seems pretty innocuous. We start peeling back layers and suddenly there's a lot to it. And I think anecdotally, we hear a lot about what's happening with sleep, and we see data saying, oh, we've got to be sleeping more, and then some people are saying, no, we should be sleeping less, and some people are saying, oh, do this thing like Ben Franklin where you sleep for a few hours, get up, do stuff, and go back to sleep and do that. It's a lot, so that we're going to try to make sense of that, because as I was doing the research for the show this week, leading up to it, I really started to get kind of concerned that perhaps we're not taking it seriously enough. There's a lot to it. But there are so many different aspects of sleep, so we're going to be taking a look at that. But there was a piece in Forbes not too long ago looking at kind of why we're not getting enough sleep and what contributes to that. One of them, you know, these are things we know. One of them is consuming caffeine too late in the day. You know, they're saying anytime after 2 p.m., that might be a little too late, and that caffeine might still be in your system. I feel like you kind of need a little perk in the afternoon.
Yeah, though. What are you supposed to do if you can't have that 2:30 cup of coffee?
I think that's the thing. It's this cycle that you hit the afternoon
that's
slump
true.
Because you've slept like crap the night before.
Because of the caffeine, so
because
then you
the
need
caffeine.
The caffeine. Oh, boy.
It's a big plot from Starbuckian folk or something. So there's that. But also alcohol. We think of it as a depressant and something that will knock you out. But in fact, too much of it can impact your sleep because you won't have that quality sleep. You won't, your body processes won't be doing all of the things they're supposed to do, which is something we're going to be talking about here on the other side of news, about those physical processes. In particular, what happens to the brain while we're sleeping is so interesting to me, because it really is like putting it through a car wash and putting away away, you know, like putting the house back in order at night. It's really, really interesting. So we're going to be talking with someone who knows a whole heck of a lot more about that than I do. Another thing cited for why we are not getting enough sleep is stress over current events. I think even no matter how you voted, I think we can all agree there's, you know, stuff in the headlines. It's a little
Things keeping you awake.
There's stuff. Yeah, there's stuff that people, you know, people are fretting about. So that kind of stuff that keeps us tossing and turning. I don't know about you, Tom, but that kind of stuff has filtered into my dreams. My dreams are like sci-fi and like Handmaid's Tale stuff these days. I mean, I had a dream that I had a dream that I was about to get like a get blood drawn, and I had to fight my way out of it, and I ended up like punching a. I'm not going to say who, but I like punched a politician who's no longer, it was a presidential candidate. But I like punched him because he was trying to draw my blood. Like all these, you know, these things are in our brains and our brains are kind of, you know, our subconscious is clearing them out. But
you might need to do a little dream interpretation, look into the works of Carl Jung.
My friend even, she said, oh, turn that into a graphic novel or something. another thing that's cited, that is not sticking to a sleep schedule. One thing I found that was really interesting researching the show this week was we kind of believe we have this idea, excuse me, that like we can catch up on sleep on the weekends.
Oh,
false. Once it's gone, it's gone. Once you don't get that good night's sleep, you cannot catch up to it. So that's another thing we're going to be talking with one of our experts about here in a bit. Pretty much once you know, you can feel refreshed again, but you can't really keep an even schedule of not sleeping well during the week and then sleeping wonderfully on the weekends. Better to just kind of try to hit the same time every night. And there's a lot of cool apps that will do that for you. I have an app that about an hour before I tell it, like I've set what my bedtime is in there, and about an hour before it'll send me a text and say, okay, let's start winding it down here.
Turn off your phones, close the computer.
Yeah, let's turn off music and TVs and, you know, start to chill a little bit and wind it down, which I find really helpful. Another aspect that was another thing that was mentioned in this Forbes piece about why we're not getting enough sleep. These two facts I thought were really interesting and pretty surprising. One of them is just the general kind of hustle and bustle of living in an urban environment. It takes a toll on the body. There's kind of mental space that occupies, just being around, you know, being in crowded public spaces, the noise of a city. Right on cue, a siren is going by.
Naturally.
As I'm saying that, right? I mean, we've got the air show going on right now, which is cool, but it's also, you know, your body does react. Everybody's eyebrows kind of go down when those very loud planes go overhead. So that kind of just kind of activity on the body and that kind of low-grade stress does have an impact, as well as not using our time off enough or well or wisely. Mm-hmm. So we got stuff to fix. It's not just
as always,
right? It's not just sleep. It's really, there's some kind of systemic stuff. I think particularly I've been thinking a lot with the show about kind of the golden handcuffs and the hyper connected world and how we're expected to sometimes answer email in the middle of the night, you know, and every little like ding and ping on our phone is the promise of another hit of dopamine of some good news or something like that. So there's a lot to that, I think, that's really kind of disrupting our sleep cycles, which again, I'm very pro technology, but I'm also pro sleep, especially after getting ready for the show. I'm super pro sleep. And even in our language, right, we reward it a little bit because we say things like, oh my gosh, you do so many things. When do you sleep? Right. And when do you sleep is like a compliment. And I sometimes people have said that to me before, and I'm like, I guard sleep pretty tightly because I'm real crabby without it and really easily confused and real dumb without it. So, you know, so there's that. Anyway, we're going to be talking all about these different aspects. And also, I want to hear from you. There'll be a couple of breaks we'll have in between some of our experts. If you have some interesting sleep habits, something that you do to help you get to sleep faster or better, something like that, we would love to hear from you because we can all learn from each other, right? Indeed, we can. So we're going to take a break and get you to news, all that good stuff. But before we take that break, learn how real Chicagoans live the day-to-day struggles and successes with health, fitness, and food. Watch Living Healthy Chicago Sundays at 11:30 a.m. on WGN-TV. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we pick one big topic and we start looking at different aspects of it and peeling back layers, and often we are left with far more questions than we started with. So tonight, that topic is sleep. It is such an important topic. It's one we hear about a lot anecdotally, right? We all know we should be sleeping more. We don't know why, but we know we should. And so here joining us to talk about that is Dr. Bharati Prasad, who is Associate Professor of Pulmonary Critical Care, Sleep and Allergy at, in the University of Illinois at the Chicago College of Medicine, and is Director of the Sleep Science Center there. Dr. Prasad, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
So sleep is such a giant topic when we talk about it, particularly around the body processes around sleep. There is so much there. You specialize particularly in the cardiovascular aspects of sleep. Tell us a bit about that and the focus of your work, if you would.
Sure. So I'm interested primarily in sleep-disordered breathing. And sleep-disordered breathing fragments sleep on a biological level that may not be perceptible to the individual that the sleep is being disturbed of. And it also causes your body to be exposed to hypoxia or low blood oxygen levels as a result of pauses in your breathing. And those two perturbations typically together cause harm to your body, particularly the cardiovascular system. And that's my area of interest, is studying what the mechanisms are and who are the people that are predisposed to this type of risk, particularly so that we can, identify them and treat them on a priority basis.
Sure, certainly. And so when you're saying fragments sleep, that really just means it's interrupting it even imperceptibly, even just in tiny
that
little bursts. Okay, so people aren't getting that really good quality sleep.
Correct.
Okay, and so we all know that getting a lack of, like, too little sleep is hurting us. We all kind of know that anecdotally. But what's really happening in the body when either with your patients who are perhaps even waking up even when they don't realize they're waking up or just not getting deep sleep, or people who are just maybe not sleeping regularly, maybe sleeping too little? Talk us through what's happening in the body when we are suffering from some degree of sleep deprivation.
Sure. There are many perturbations that go on in the autonomic nervous system, in the endocrine and the metabolic system. And certainly, there's a lot of research on sleep being very important to memory and learning. So all of those areas of functioning are affected. You can imagine, young students, adolescents who tend to go to bed late for a number of reasons and therefore have what we call insufficient sleep. That is, a lot to do with behavior and the social schedule. Their learning and memory may be impacted. Young workers, for example, shift workers, even so, not only the duration of sleep, but the timing of sleep is also important for optimum functioning. And then, there is a good amount of literature now that suggests that just not sleeping enough may in and of itself be a risk for cardiometabolic conditions, including, glucose intolerance or frank diabetes. There may be some risk for increase in blood pressure just related to insufficient sleep. So it does affect your health in many ways.
Interesting. I was reading one of those papers prior to the show, getting ready for our conversation, and I also ran across some literature that suggested it was talking in particular about metabolic issues and perhaps even insulin resistance, and perhaps we don't maybe we can't process insulin or process sugar as effectively on too little sleep, which is very interesting because we think of it as being kind of an isolated thing, but it's really sounding more and more like sleep is impacts so many different bodily systems.
it does, truly. I mean, it's, you know, this is one of the reasons why this is a biological function that's preserved through so many species. You know, it dates back to prevertebrates. You know, there's some evidence in, like, you know, there's cyclical activity and turning off similar to sleep in very, you know, primitive organisms as well. So,
right. And so how are those sleep guidelines set? What is it that medically really is being measured when we say we need this many hours of sleep? You know, we hear sometimes 7 to 9, sometimes we'll hear more for a while, then sometimes we'll hear less. What is it that we're looking for as a marker when we decide what number of sleep is enough?
Sure. So this is, you know, mostly based out of what we call normative data. So, you know, a very large general population is surveyed, and then we look at the norms and essentially say that, well, what is 95% of the normal, otherwise, you know, apparently healthy population doing? And then sort of take those numbers, and that's where you get the 7 to 9 hours of sleep. There is some interesting data to say that, and that's how you start to measure insufficient sleep, by defining a lower limit of normal using those normative data. And then you look at, so what happens when you look at 6 hours of sleep, individuals who do 5 hours of sleep a night, and so on. So there are, you know, that you can do that experimentally to understand what insufficient sleep does for you. You can do that observationally to look at people who report getting that much sleep or measured sleep. And it's interesting that there's a lot of things about insufficient sleep, but when you look at death, which is, you know, I guess in arguably the final health outcome, it's both ways. So less sleep affects mortality, as well as more than 9 hours of sleep affects mortality. So it's sort of a U-shaped curve. And that's why putting all this together, now this is only true for adults. Obviously, sleep does change completely and dramatically through the life cycle, right? So for children and infants, it's a very different story. Adolescents are different from adults, and older adults are different from middle-aged adults.
Yeah, that was my very next question for you, is how does that differ? Because I think we have this narrative that, oh, teens sleep all day, and as we age, we need less sleep. And so how does that, when do those shifts occur?
Yeah, so teens, you know, pretty early in adolescence, I think there's a biological change, and there is what we call a preference for going to bed late. And it's not, you know, at first it was thought that this is due to homework and social schedule and such, but it appears that there may be an actual biological change that makes the adolescents go to bed later than they did as, say, 10-year-olds or 8-year-olds. And this continues through most of the young adulthood, or at least the early 20s. I think, you know, maybe going to work and such, social cues kick in and such, or it may be related to aging, but then you start to adopt a more normal sleep schedule. By the time you're older, and I don't know, maybe 65 or so, you start to become what is, you know, termed a polyphasic sleeper, if you will. So elderly tend to sleep less in the nighttime as in one bout, and may, you know, go to bed early, wake up early, but then nap during the day. So the shift is sort of towards the polyphasic sleepers. Then getting older, you may have less slow wave or deep sleep as well.
I'm glad you mentioned polyphasic, because as more and more literature is emerging around this notion of biohacking, people using different supplements and enzymes, that kind of thing, to try to elicit different, brain function and increase memory, things like that. There is more and more that keeps popping up about biphasic sleep, and I think even Benjamin Franklin was cited as this, you know, big proponent of sleeping a couple of times through the night, getting up in the middle of the night, doing stuff. What is your opinion on that? Is that, it seems like at one point it was quite widespread and we've moved away from that.
Right. So, you know, in many cultures, you're right that people still have the siesta hour, and for sure it may not be like 4 and 4 in the night and day, but it certainly could look something like 6 hours at night and 2 hours during the day. I think, you know, anecdotally, it's considered cultural, but also these are countries that tend to have less cardiovascular disease and, you know, less maybe mortality for age. So it's hard to attribute that, of course, to these cultural habits, but certainly it doesn't seem to harm health. The other, you know, research piece that has occurred has been with shift workers. So, for example, they don't really have the luxury of sleeping, say, 9 hours or 8 hours. And so, for example, in medicine, the residents or, you know, the pilots, they are advised to break up their sleep into blocks of maybe 4 hours or so. And that has to do with, you know, the rhythm of sleep. And you go through light, through deep, through REM sleep in about a 90 to 120 minute period. And so if you get your 2-4 hours of sleep or say 3 hours of sleep, you're through one or two cycles of that sleep. And that is considered restorative as far as at least alertness and functioning is concerned. So I think there are some maybe scattered pieces of data that seem to suggest that, you know, biphasic sleep is not a bad thing.
Right, right. Well, it is interesting. I mean, I'm all for the idea of bringing back naps. I'm totally on board with that part for sure.
Right.
Well, and, you know, my own grandfather, he often, you know, knock on wood, he is still with us. And he always says, well, the secret to longevity for me is I take a nap every day. So there may be something to that, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when we're looking at sleep habits or maybe sleep needs of men and women, do we see a difference there, too?
Yes. So, you know, sleep habits, for example, women take longer on the average to fall asleep. The sleep latency tends to be shorter, so they fall asleep very quickly. This is, I think, all married women can attest to this. They also, you know, women perceive more problems with their sleep, but when you actually measure sleep, they overall generally tend to have more deep sleep and healthier sleep. Yeah, there are gender differences for sure. In terms of sleep requirements, there are no glaring differences overall.
That's interesting, though, that we tend to think our sleep is not as high quality as it is. What do you attribute mm-hmm. that to?
That's sort of hard to tell. I'm not aware of any literature that really particularly addresses that. This is observational.
Sure.
It may have to do with, you know, how easily you wake up or how much you perceive your short wakenings. For example, you know, women tend to suffer more from insomnia. If you look at sleep problems, there's a very strong gender preponderance in women. I think it probably has to do with the arousal mechanism in women.
Sure, sure. Well, that's very, very interesting. And then what about when, I know a lot lately we've been looking and hearing so much about the screens and that blue light, and as new phones come out, we see different mechanisms to minimize or put a nighttime setting on our phones. Where you see this in a much more impactful and clinical way, what are we missing when we're talking about screens and that blue light that you see? You probably see it in much clearer terms, and you probably saw mm-hmm. it long before we started talking about it.
Mm-hmm. True. So, you know, it's a very strong alerting a stimulus, if you will. So light in general is very, very strong stimulating effect on the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the part of your brain that regulates the circadian rhythm, that is your body's sleep-wake cycle as it relates to night and day, so the 24-hour cycle. And the circadian rhythm of your sleep is primarily an alerting influence. So anything that stimulates it is an alerting influence. And so light is alerting, but the important thing about light is the timing of exposure. So it can change when you go to sleep or how easily you fall asleep based on the time of exposure. And so at night, when your body is cooling down, and, you know, all the other biological signals are in favor of falling asleep, right? That blue light exposure is actually fighting some of that and is counterproductive.
Just as terrible as everyone says.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so how many hours should we, or how much time anyway, should we be away from our screens prior to trying to go to sleep?
Right. Absolutely. No, that's a great question. And I think I would say at the very least 2 hours.
So you're not going to be happy with me because I usually read on my phone before I go to sleep.
Yeah. And, you know, I will say this, though. I mean, most, you know, e-readers and stuff have the night screens, as you say. And I'm not sure how effective they are, whether they do have any adverse effects or not. If this has been researched, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's something we've definitely, I think we're all, now that we're becoming more aware of it, I think we're starting to take it a little more seriously. But I think it'll be interesting to see kind of the each new generation of phone. It seems to tackle it a little bit more here and there. I also would like to ask you about, there's a white paper that the NIH put out about, particularly about the brain process of kind of sleep being sort of a reset button for the brain, which I found very, very interesting because it really kind of describes it like putting it kind of through a car wash, like putting away all the files, storing memories, cleaning the brain of toxins, which I think is something we don't talk a lot about. But I think as we are trying to kind of figure out more about Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and things like that, more conversations are kind of pointing to something like a brain plaque or toxins in the brain, things like that. Where are those lines with sleep? And what is your opinion on that?
You know, I would say that the normal biological function, so if you look at the theory of how sleep happens and what the function might be, one of the basic theories of how sleep happens is the sleep switch. So there are these wake chemicals in your brain and there are these sleep-promoting chemicals in your brain, and they're mutually suppressive. So with the daylight cycle, when one becomes active, the other is actively turned off. So, you know, when you go to sleep, you actually actively suppress all of the wake-promoting chemicals in your brain. And so it's, you know, it's, you could think that that is the role, is to actively turn off those chemicals for a while. And like you said, to let your brain reset and rest.
Right, right. It is really, really fascinating because I think we kind of anecdotally think about sleep being just kind of being out, being about stopping. But it sounds like our bodies are really quite active while we're sleeping, in fact.
Yep.
And so why did you pick sleep as your focus? It is such an interesting topic, and there's still so much mystery around it, you know, about really what sleep even is. I think it's something that's kind of even been poetic at times, and people have wrestled with in you know, arts and literature even. But why was this the focus that appealed to you personally?
For sure. So my background is in pulmonology, or, you know, breathing disorders. And I'm very interested in the control of breathing, which is very, very affected by sleep. It is amazing how things can be very different during sleep as compared to wakefulness with your breathing. And it's true for, you know, your heart function and many of your organ systems as well. But breathing actually manifests itself as a very important disorder that we know about today. So that's what drew me to sleep.
Excellent. Well, we're glad that you're on the topic. We have all learned so much from talking with you tonight. And so what is the one thing that you wish more people were mindful of or thought more about or you know, thought about or knew even about sleep?
Mm-hmm. For sure. So I think I hope that people have realized that sleep is just as important as exercise, as eating right. It is one of the key pillars of health.
And we should not skimp on it.
That is absolutely right.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Bharati Prasad. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. Director of the Sleep Science Center at University of Illinois Chicago College of Medicine, thank you for sharing your knowledge and all of your wisdom with us tonight. We definitely learned so much from you. I hope you'll join us again sometime on the show.
Thank you for having me. Good night.
Thanks so much. All right, we are going to take a break. We're going to get you to news, all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with Dr. Melissa Melby, who is a professor at the University of Delaware, about practices around sleep all around the world, because sleep is not sleep is not sleep. It is different all everywhere we look. So we're going to be talking about that and taking a look about sleep throughout history. Very, very interesting stuff. Back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. As that song that is playing right now suggests, tonight's topic is sleep. It is one of those topics we think, oh, that's pretty straightforward. Everyone should sleep and sleep enough. Oh, contraire. There's so much to it as we have been digging in on this subject. Indeed, it is, as ever, right? We pick a topic that seems straightforward and it quickly becomes something more complex. We were talking about kind of the medical processes and everything that's happening to our bodies while we're sleeping with our previous guest. And now let's shift that outward and talk about practices around sleeping, particularly around the world. And the reason, here, let me tell you how we found our next guest. There's a really interesting piece that I found in Atlas Obscura, which is a really, really cool publication that they do really thoughtful and kind of different pieces than what you normally see everywhere else. But they had a piece about why, it was called Why Do We Sleep Under Blankets Even on the Hottest Nights? And the second I saw that headline, I went, oh yeah, that is a thing. We all do that, right? Even if you just have like the tiniest corner of the sheets or something like right over your waist, you got to have a little something like a blanket. So I started thinking about that. And I read this piece and it's so very interesting. And that is where I came across the work of our next guest, Dr. Melissa Melby, assistant professor at University of Delaware, who really studies this, this sleep habits and what we do around sleep and how people around the world sleep. Because indeed, sleep is not sleep is not sleep. We all sleep quite differently, as it turns out. Dr. Melby, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us and taking time out of your weekend. I appreciate it. So tell us about this study that you compiled about sleeping habits and arrangements in different parts of the world. What an interesting topic. How did you stumble upon that topic and what were your findings?
Well, so when I started this, I was a graduate student, and my then advisor posed a question of how people spend about a third of their lives. And anthropologists like to look at cultural and biological factors that influence variation in human behavior, and we tend to look comparatively, we look cross-culturally at phenomena such as sleep, and we try to answer the question, what is normal for humans? But because anthropologists are usually sleeping when their participants are sleeping, we actually know very little about what they do during that time. We generally go and live with the people we're studying, but we don't usually sleep with them.
Right.
So what we did for this study, and a little ethical issue there. So
right.
What we did for this study was we basically interviewed anthropologists who have worked with people who have different kind of subsistence or sort of lifestyle, mm-hmm. Such as foragers, people that are hunter-gatherers, which is what most humans were for most of human history. And pastoralists and horticulturalists and agriculturalists, and we interviewed them to get a sense of what sleep might have looked like in our evolutionary history and also what it looks like cross-culturally. And we found a great deal of variation.
How interesting. And so what are, when we think about sleep habits, our last guest mentioned cultures that have kind of that afternoon nap as one reference point, but what other things come up very quickly when we start looking at sleep habits around the world?
So, yes, I think the idea that we don't all sleep just one big block of time at night, that is very common. But I think if you start expanding to think about the environment, one thing that's very common in many cultures is the presence of fire, and it provides light. And in our culture, we tend to think of having complete darkness as being a good thing. It also provides smoke, which is an irritant to us for breathing, but it also keeps away mosquitoes, which is a problem for many, many people around the world. And perhaps maybe most importantly, the presence of fire often requires that somebody tends the fire. And so there's waking up periodically and social interaction that occurs throughout the night. And this is a very different picture of what we tend to think of as normal sleep here in our society and in our laboratories especially.
Right, right. And then you've done a great deal of work around sleep in Japan. Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've been working in Japan for about 15 years, looking at factors that influence mostly women's health, both midlife women's health and maternal child health. And you know, many of the listeners may be aware that Japanese tend to sleep on futons, which are much thinner than our typical Western or U.S. American bedding substrates. And that's very different around the world, too. People sleep in hammocks. They sleep on sleeping platforms. They sleep directly on the forest floor sometimes. They use a lot of different kinds of bedding garments as well. And the Japanese use futons, which they generally air out daily. They hang them out. And that can prevent dust mites and things like that that often interfere with sleep. And in the West, we have a lot of bedding. So that's one issue. Certainly, naps are very common for people that are doing physical labor, like rice farming. But also, Japanese are kind of famous for their sleep deprivation and what's called inemuri, which is roughly translated as sleeping on the job or sleeping while present. And many people, especially the men, especially white-collar men, will nod off during meetings. And certainly if anybody's ever been on a Japanese train, at the end of the day, half the people couldn't be sleeping. So that is very common. But I'd say probably the most important for me attribute of Japanese and their sleeping is sort of over the life course and co-sleeping behaviors. And I think that sort of briefly came up a little bit maybe with your previous guest, but co-sleeping with other people in the West, we tend to think of sleep as a very solitary act unless you're sleeping with your married partner. And certainly in most laboratories, most of the studies are of people that are sleeping by themselves, except there are some good studies of co-sleeping done by Jim McKenna, if you're interested. But in Japan, it's kind of a cultural ideal to sleep with children until roughly about age 10, but I know several people who have slept with their children until age 14, which to many Americans sounds quite shocking. But we've seen in our survey of sleep habits around the world that it's very common to have sleep be integrated with visiting and guests coming over. And I was once interviewing a participant who lived in a neighboring town. She invited me to spend the night for dinner and stay overnight because I was cycling to her house. And when I went into the tatami mat room that's usually reserved for guests, I noticed that two futons had been laid out. And I wondered who I was going to be sleeping with. Turned out I was sleeping with her. She didn't want me to be lonely. And this is very common around the world that sleep is considered to be a social act, not a solitary one.
How interesting. Because, right, as you're describing that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, that would be so awkward. You're so vulnerable when you're sleeping. How could you just sleep in a room with a stranger? But what an interesting shift in thinking there. That this woman didn't want you to be lonely while you were sleeping in that room.
It's almost the opposite there. They would be worried that I would not be able to sleep by myself. And there was another time when I went to a ryokan, which is a traditional Japanese inn, with a couple participants and their husbands. They were sort of treating me to this special weekend away. We had a lovely meal, relaxed in the onsen, the hot springs there, and then we retired to our room. And our hotel room was a room with five futons that had been laid out. So I slept with my participants, just sleeping, and their husbands. And so, again, this sounds strange to many Americans. You're not going to be sleeping with people you're studying generally. But this communal sleeping is not unusual for Japanese and really is considered the cultural ideal. And I think many people feel they sleep better with people in their environments.
How interesting. Oh, my gosh. I think that would take a little getting used to, indeed. And so you said also that you focus a lot on women's sleeping habits. Where do you start seeing a division in the sleeping habits of men versus women?
That's an excellent question. I think certainly when children are born, you see a big difference. And many anthropologists study the behaviors of co-sleeping and parenting. And you do see, not only in Japan and most traditional cultures, but even in the U.S., I've found that when I confess that I have co-slept with my children, quite a lot of Americans will kind of quietly confess that they do too, but they don't want to tell anybody because they think there's such a taboo against that. So I think women generally start changing their sleeping behaviors often when they are breastfeeding and sleeping with their children. And I think you have a lot of differences in arousal that occur because of the need to wake up or go into slightly different sleep-awake stages in order to breastfeed your child and be aware of your child. Many parents that I have interviewed and people have commented often it's the partner will notice the woman doesn't even seem to fully wake up. And we have some lab data suggesting that's true in order to take care of her child during the night. So you start seeing some real differences in men and women, I think, at the point when children are born.
Right. Do you see any prior to that? Are there just kind of some innate differences in sleeping habits that maybe are socialized or the result of being socialized in some other way that maybe manifest even earlier?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I certainly, in our survey of populations around the world, you see that in many cultures, it's much more acceptable for young adolescent males to start having a lot more independence at that time in terms of sleeping, staying up later, being out with friends, whereas girls tend to be more heavily guarded in most societies, and their sleeping environments are much more constrained. So some of the sleep differences that we see, it's hard to know if they're biological or if they're just culturally constrained. We don't tend to have such gender differences in our society, mm-hmm. But certainly around the world and probably throughout human history, there have been some real differences in the way adolescents and young women and men have been treated in terms of what's permissible and what's acceptable and desirable for sleeping.
Right, right. I'm sure some of that has something to do with safety and factors like that, and, mm-hmm. and that vulnerability
certainly.
Of being relatively defenseless while you're sleeping. So
exactly, and that's something that has been part of our history with macro yeah. predators, you know, big animals that have been, and not just those, but also all the micro predators, mosquitoes and things like that.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure, that's true too. So a lot of the descriptions of the kind of how you parcel out thinking about sleep in mm-hmm. in the paper that you. You put together in this and the data that you compiled, it really seems like it breaks it into physical, cultural, and biotic aspects, mm-hmm. really, to kind of parcel it out into three different buckets. And so help us think through the nuances of those three aspects, if you would.
So again, the physical is physical environment like fire, different types of bedding, whether you have light, darkness. I mean, most places are fairly dark, but you may have the firelight. The bedding can be hammocks or platforms. You know, the contrast I think that's important is in Western environments like our culture, we tend to think that it should be silent, it should be dark, it should be solitary, it should be climate controlled. You should be sleeping on a mattress with pillows. And that's very different from most non-Western societies where it is certainly dark, but there's usually a fair bit of noise and there's not so much climate control and the bedding substrate is very different and fire. In terms of biotic, even though many people in our culture do sleep with their pets, it's less kind of pets that people are sleeping with, but rather concerns about animals, or it's their domesticated animals that they're sleeping with, or concerns about mosquitoes and things like that. I think perhaps one of the most interesting, again, for me, is that the kind of social aspect of it, the kinds of conversations that go on, the visiting and traveling. And I heard your earlier part of your program, and this idea of sleep deprivation, we tend to think in our culture of sleep deprivation is a pretty negative thing with no positive benefits. But there are many cultures where sleep deprivation actually can lead to sort of altered states like trance and ritualistic behaviors that are highly socially valued. So there are aspects of sleep deprivation that I think probably historically, evolutionarily, and cross-culturally are very valued, but ones that we in our culture currently do not value much at all.
That is a very, very interesting point. And so when we're talking, I think it's so interesting, this focus on bedding. I find that very, very interesting, because even I'm thinking of just not long ago, maybe in the last 2 weeks, I saw an ad for this blanket that weighs like 50 pounds or something, and it's supposed to soothe anxiety or something. And that sounds miserable to have this 50-pound weight laying on you. But it reminded me of like those, what are they called? The thunder something. It's like a thunder shirt or something. It's like this weighted mm-hmm. thing you put on animals when they're upset about storms or change in their environment, something mm-hmm. like that.
Especially for people with sensory issues, that kind
right.
of heavy pressure can be very helpful. Yeah,
sure, sure. And so I think this focus on bedding is very interesting. And of course, that Atlas Obscura piece that I mentioned earlier, that is a kind of a funny phenomenon that this, and perhaps it's only Western, right? That this idea of even putting the tiniest corner of bedding on ourselves when it's very, very
yes,
hot.
I'm one of those people, I confess. But certainly there are many people around the world that can sleep happily without anything, or just use their own clothing to kind of get comfortable. So people don't, not everywhere, is bedding used. Although in Japan, your point about this heavy thing, in the north of Japan where I did some field work, my parents actually came to visit once, and they stayed with one of my participants, really good friends of ours, and they bought special duvet covers, or basically special duvets or futons, upper futons for my parents. And they were essentially these incredibly heavy blankets, but they had armholes, so they were sleeves. It kind of looked like an outfit. I have some lovely pictures of my parents in those. So there are all sorts of interesting patterns of sleep bedding and around the world.
Okay. A cover with armholes sounds very adorable.
Yeah, it goes all the way up to your neck, and it's freezing cold. They don't have any heat in their houses. They use kerosene stoves, but you can't keep those going all night. So things actually freeze. Like, I had a glass of water out on my table at night, and this is in Fukushima Prefecture, which is now famous for its nuclear disaster. But in the wintertime, it gets very cold there, and many of the homes don't have any kind of heat. So the cups of water will freeze at night. And, you know, in the morning when you stick your hand in the refrigerator, it feels warm because it's warmer than actually outside. So they have some very serious bedding. Yeah.
Wow. I should hope they do. So when we're looking at just Western sleeping habits, how have those habits shifted, or maybe attitudes around sleeping? How has that shifted over time?
Well, I think you can say that certainly in the last probably 50 plus years or so, with changes in socioeconomic status and living standards, we've seen big changes in terms of co-sleeping. This ideal of everybody having their own bedroom is a fairly recent phenomenon, and still only really accessible to people that have certain resources. And the idea of certain sleep times and duration, I think, is also kind of an artifact of the kind of work lives we lead, fairly, very highly scheduled. I think, as the previous guest, Dr. Prasad, was talking about, you know, sleep needs change over the life course. Unfortunately, our society and our work lives these days are not very forgiving about that. So children have to get to daycare when their parents have to get to work. And so that can often interfere with sleeping patterns. And certainly adolescents are a big issue that's in the news a lot these days.
Right, right, sure. And so what are the things people don't know about sleep, or that you wish they knew or understood more accurately or in a more nuanced way? Because so often, you know, particularly in a field of academic research, as that research is described, it gets almost distilled down to kind of a soundbite kind of way, or maybe there's a dominant narrative or kind of anecdotal popular thinking around something. What is the thing that you just want to just kind of shake people and make them understand about sleeping or sleeping habits?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think as an anthropologist, one of my guiding principles, I suppose, when it comes to any kind of particularly behavioral or health related guidelines, the previous guest talked about normative data. And unfortunately, I think with respect to most health concerns, our normative data is generally collected on people like us living in the West and in very kind of constrained environments and social situations. And if we look back through human evolutionary history and across culturally and think about the ways in which people live around the world, you see a lot more variation. And so I think maybe the take-home message for me is to recognize, when you hear new guidelines about anything, think about the kind of diversity of environments that humans have lived in, and question a little bit about what is normal, and whether our you know, one block of sleep at night and sleeping alone and sleeping completely with ideally no stimuli whatsoever, if that really is normal. There's some questions about whether maybe all these sleep disorders that we're seeing, and even attention issues, you know, attention deficit disorder, maybe a lot of these things have to do with regulation of our systems that are kind of entrained, especially since a third of our time is spent sleeping. If we're sleeping in these very sort of artificially controlled environments, unlike what we probably have slept in evolutionarily with lots of people and noise and light, that may be affecting our system's ability to regulate itself when faced with lots of stimuli. And so it may have some unintended consequences.
Yeah, that is a very, very interesting point. I think we even preparing for the show, I was seeing all this data and reading all these, all these papers and all this stuff about sleep. And I thought, oh, we're not taking this seriously enough, but perhaps maybe we're taking it, I don't want to say too seriously, but maybe we're coming at it the wrong way. We're thinking about it in just a very local way and only thinking of our part of the world. That is a very, very good point.
I think it's a very serious issue, but we need to realize that there's a lot more variation, and humans have always exhibited a lot of variation. So before we decide what is the optimal, we need to look at the environments. And of course, our environment is very constrained, and we have to find sleep patterns that fit our demands, right?
So. Right, right. All very, very interesting stuff. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge. Dr. Melissa Melby, assistant professor at University of Delaware. Thank you. And I hope you can come back and visit us sometime and talk about sleep another day.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is a Saturday Night Special. Shout out to esteemed producer Tom Hush for playing a little Metallica on that one. Nice. Gotta let that one play out a second. Well, so tonight's topic is sleep. We have been talking all about sleep, and we have been talking with some very interesting academics in the field. Dr. Melissa Melby was talking about sleep practices around the world and habits and how people in different parts of the world sleep. And Dr. Bharati Prasad was talking about the physical things that are happening to us when we sleep and how important sleep is to our body. But I want to shift now because we always have to have this creative element in here and look at different aspects of any topic that we talk about. And I'm very honored to welcome to the program now filmmaker Rodney Asher, who is the director of many, many films, one called Room 237, which has nothing to do with this show, but I highly recommend you go check that one out. But also the director of The Nightmare, which is about sleep paralysis. It feels like a horror movie. It really does. But in fact, it is a documentary that is really quite terrifying and quite interesting and very, very beautifully done. Rodney, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Oh, I'm honored that you're here. I think this film is so interesting and so beautifully done. It really doesn't feel like a documentary. It feels like you're watching a horror film. And many of the reviews of the film were kind of the same mind on that one. So for those who may not be familiar, tell us a bit about the film, The Nightmare.
Well, sure. I mean, The Nightmare is a look at sleep paralysis through the experience of 8 people who've gone through it. And, you know, if you're not familiar with sleep paralysis, and, you know, one of the reasons I made the movie is because it seems like something that not enough people talk about. It's this strange place sort of on the borders between sleeping and waking where people find themselves awake in bed, usually in the middle of the night, unable to move, unable to make a sound. Often, you know, they start seeing things. And, you know, one of the really strange things about it is a lot of them see the same kind of things, most frequently sort of this black, three-dimensional, you know, sort of living, moving, breathing silhouette of a person, frequently called the Shadow Man.
Which sounds absolutely terrifying, truly. And you capture that so well in this film. So why did you take on this topic in particular?
Well, I mean, the first reason is because it happened to me, you know, and when something like that happens to you, and it was years before I found out that, you know, it was even something that had ever happened to anyone else that had a name, that, you know, that there were descriptions about it in, you know, literature from like sleep studies. I mean, when it happened to me, I just thought I was having a supernatural experience. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, you know, this terrifying, seemingly supernatural thing was a lot more common than I knew or I suspected was, you know, the primary mover for the film. But I was also coming off of Room 237, which is a documentary about a horror movie. And the idea of moving from there to a documentary that sort of was a horror movie. Mm-hmm. And there's also, like, there's something that I came across, you know, as in my research that, you know, it may well be that this kind of experience influenced a lot of classic, you know, folk tales and superstitions, you know, from the incubus, the succubus, the vampire. Even Frankenstein was seemingly inspired by Mary Shelley having sleep paralysis while she was on vacation. The idea that sleep paralysis in the things that people see while they are experiencing it inspired these stories that then became our horror movies. All that sort of came together. You know, and argued for, you know, sort of using the vocabulary of horror movies in the film itself.
Very, very interesting. That is a very interesting point, this idea of it, of this experience being kind of the catalyst of what inspired so many other works in the horror genre is really, really fascinating. So how did you approach this film? I mean, that seems like such a... kind of difficult conversation to talk about with somebody, to broach that topic. You know, when you, sleep is already something that seems so personal. And if you have this experience, I have not had this experience. You said that you have. I imagine it's something that you probably don't just pull that story out every, too often. So how do you approach that with relative strangers as you are making this?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're exactly right. And, I hear from so many people, who say, I was afraid to tell anyone. I've never talked about this in my life. I was afraid that people would think that I was crazy. But on the other hand, whenever I would talk about the subject with any group of people, I mean, if it was more than four or five people, chances are somebody would say, oh, my God, that happened to me. Hmm. So, I mean, my approach on this, and this is sort of seemingly becoming what I do for most of these projects. Instead of trying to do an encyclopedia A to Z look at every aspect of a subject, I try to zero in on sort of first person experiences. So I decided early on that the focus of the film was just going to be people who've gone through it telling their stories. And half of the people we found who are people who are already talking about it in public, mm-hmm. people who had written books or articles or postings online about it. But then we made an announcement about the film and set up a Facebook page, and we were very quickly overwhelmed, with hundreds of people, who wanted to share their stories. I still get them.
Oh, how interesting. And so what is most commonly misunderstood about sleep paralysis?
That's tricky because people have a lot of different ideas about it, and it's hard to prove or disprove, most of them. There are a lot of folks who are certain that this is, that in this state, you are more prone to, kind of a supernatural experience. And there are, other folks who say, no, this is just, something that happens in your mind, that this is a strange combination of dreaming and consciousness, and you're sort of projecting a dream over what you're seeing, that it may be scary, but it's really just, your mind playing a trick on you.
It is a tricky one. I mean, it is kind of, it's a strange topic, right? Because it would be very natural to assume that or question or feel like, if you wake up and you see something standing at the foot of your bed, I think most people go, okay, that was definitely supernatural, or I was dreaming. But to be kind of in a state of limbo between those two, between waking and dreaming, I think would be quite terrifying. And so as you've been talking to people on this topic, is it traumatic to them, or is it something that they kind of rationalize, or is it kind of an array of reactions?
It's an array. There are people who, like in my case, I had it once really badly and then never again. I had it a handful of times, but it was never as intense or as frightening as that first time.
Okay.
There are folks who get over it. There are folks, who experience it kind of chronically, though they are, sort of in the minority. It's kind of, there's more science on it now even than when I began the project. There's a pretty good, there's a pretty good book on it. Was it Oxford that published? That's pretty encompassing. But even with it, it's because it's so unpredictable. It isn't as if it's an easy thing to observe in any kind of laboratory condition. And, there's certainly not any kind of, people ask, how do I get it and how do I stop getting it? Mm-hmm. The answer to both is, well, there's a handful of things that sometimes cause it, and there are a handful of things that sometimes cure it. But, neither is, 100% reliable.
Interesting. What are some of those predictors for triggering something like that?
Yeah, well, I think the most common ones are a lot of anxiety, not sleeping regular hours. Certainly, it seems to be more common, in your early 20s, You know, so I can you can imagine that there are a lot of stressed out college students going through it.
Right.
You know, and you know, there are things that, you know, sometimes help people get over it, like, you know, trying to eliminate stress. Good luck. Finding, you know, trying to sleep more regularly. So when you're, you know, seeing, you know, menacing shadow people in the room with you, sometimes it's you're not necessarily inclined to go to sleep early, not night and early every night.
Or at all, ever again. And I mean, even
you know,
in your project, you...
Even Darren Elm Street talks about that.
Right. You're right. And there were in the project, you know, these people are talking about like almost like an audio hallucination of hearing voices and even very specific threatening language. Is there any sort of, you know...
In recurring characters... You know, Forrest, one of the guys in the film, you know, one of the, you know, strangest things he said was that when he would sleep in different places, his childhood home, his new apartment, a friend's house, he would often encounter different things and different voices. And when he went back, you know, to one of the other ones, the older ones would return.
Ooh, I got goosebumps. That sounds so terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't think that would be very conducive to getting more sleep, certainly. That would be really, that would put a lot of anxiety around your sleep schedule, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and some folks have found, you know, success, you know, with religion or meditation. So again, pretty hard to prove or disprove in any kind of clinical setting.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and when you get...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it's like, you know, often, you know, in many areas of my life, I tend to be more or less skeptical. But, you know, on either side of the equation here, you know, if it's just a weird kind of dream, you know, or if it's something real that is usually invisible, but in this case you can see, there's always a loose end or two for me on either side of the argument, you know, so I've sort of settled into being happily able to let the questions live unanswered in my own mind.
Yeah, sure. So let's switch a bit to the filmmaking part of this, because you did such a beautiful job in this film of
thank you
for making it so beautiful. It's a lovely film, but you did such a lovely job of kind of how you put these things on screen, which I think is really challenging. Anytime you have, you know, in documentary in particular, that's so challenging of how you portray these things. How did you approach putting these terrifying experiences and these waking dreams into these images?
Well, I mean, one thing, you know, was we approached it very simply. You know, that there's, you know, most things that you see on screen are practical. There's, you know, a handful of digital effects, but not a ton. And I also, you know, resisted the temptation to dress it up, to make things happen that were more outrageous or more spectacular than what people said, because a lot of what they said was, you know, pretty disturbing on its own.
It didn't need dressing up. Plenty of it was scary enough.
You know, we also decided to, you know, instead of we shot the interviews in the people's real houses, and we tried to do them at night, you know, sort of at the scene of the crime. And when things happened at the places that the people were describing, you know, like there's a woman who kind of goes to her bedroom and sort of points at a window or the side of the bed where she saw things, we would try to build the set to resemble that room as closely as possible. But since we did it all in the studio, we had room to work around and sort of present things, you know, as diagrams. But even if the sets were very simple, we tried to do stuff that was much more atmospheric and dramatic with the lighting. You know, we had Bridger Nielsen, who was the cinematographer, you know, was very careful, you know, and did a beautiful job with how he lit all the scenes. You know, and often it would just be a very, very slow, deliberate camera movements, you know, that would, you know, kind of reveal, you know, would reveal what was menacing these people sort of at the end of a long kind of dolly shot. Mm-hmm. You know, and we also, a handful of times, would shoot off of a set and reveal some of the studio working. You know, I'm kind of a believer in the idea that in documentary, there's a very constantly challenging relationship between truth and fiction when working in a documentary. And I kind of find that being upfront of with the things that you are manipulating is kind of like putting your cards on the table. Not trying to fool anyone into thinking that, you know, we had a special camera that could actually capture the shadow people when they arrived. And so we showed a little bit of the mechanisms mm-hmm. of the sets, although we tried to do that even in a way that was a little unusual and dreamlike, you know, and not completely let the air out of the tires that way.
Sure.
But, you know, I storyboarded things pretty carefully so that, you know, we had edited the interviews, you know, first, you know, and I knew exactly, you know, how long each of the shots were going to last. You know, we didn't have a script in the studio. We just had a series of, you know, comic book-like drawings, storyboards that I had done. And I would know that, like, there's a moment when Chris describes the fact that sometimes leaving a TV on would keep these things from menacing him at night. And after a while, one didn't work, so it got two. And then two didn't work, so it got four, and so on and so on, that he would find these abandoned TVs in the garbage and just cram them all into his apartment. So, like, on the set, we would play back his interview so that Bridger could move the camera from the close to the one to reveal the second to slowly showing the whole tower in the corner in a way that was timed to the original interview. And while hearing, you know, Chris's authentic, you know, voice during the film, I mean, you could hear the emotion, yeah. And how these stories still had a charge to the people who were telling them.
Yeah. And so often with documentary, it really starts with a question and wanting to answer a question or explore a topic, really. And so as you started the process, were you thinking of this about, I just want to explore this topic because I experienced it? And did that shift during the process? I'm thinking in particular because so many people have pointed to it being so terrifying and so much like a horror movie. So there's kind of this camp around this film that maybe it's there to scare people, but also to educate them and then also to answer questions. And it seems like it kind of simultaneously treads all three paths in a way.
Well, thanks. Certainly, you know, all that stuff was within, you know, the ambition of what we were trying to do. You know, works for some people, doesn't always work for everybody. Mm-hmm. But, the horror part, you know, it's both, again, that idea that these sorts of experiences are likely to have inspired horror movies, though, in, you know, through multiple games of telephone, you know, even if the people writing or directing some contemporary horror movies weren't the people who experienced this, that they're building on stories that came out of it. But also, you know, I'm trying to show the both in Room 237 and in this film, I'm trying to show the world through the eyes of the people telling the stories. And if these people were going through something, you know, very scary, you know, I'd like the audience to feel that, you know. And you also can't discount, you know, if the power of the music and sound design, and Jonathan Snipes, who did them both, you know, is an incredibly talented musician. And what was great was he was also able to do all the sound effects. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them come from organic sounds of like a library that included like heartbeats and breathing and even like electrical scans of human brains.
Wow.
So, you know, all that stuff, especially if you can hear it on good speakers, you know, it's going to be part of the effect. You know, so it's probably more to show people what this is like through the eyes of these people than something that is rigorously educational. You know, I tried to get in a little bit of the science, but only as a way of reflecting the journey and the research that these people made themselves in their search to understand things.
Right, right. It is very much about the people telling the stories and not, you know, less about this topic and more the people telling the stories. It's kind of just everybody, it seems like everyone just kind of steps aside and lets these stories just exist and unfold. It is really an interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, and there was an idea that became important to me kind of early on, you know, which is, you know, again, if we're talking about, you know, something that's supposed to be scary is, you know, and this kind of works for however you see the phenomenon, that it's certainly scary to be paralyzed in bed, unable to call for help while you see, you know, black spiders or old women or, you know, shadowy figures with red eyes, you know, looming over you, you know, is terrifying on its surface. But, you know, what's also terrifying is not being able to trust your own eyes, you know, or being afraid that you're crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so either way, you know, I always hope that, you know, these sorts of projects will open up, you know, larger conversations outside of this specific narrow topic, you know, that we started from.
Yeah, certainly. Well, again, the film is called The Nightmare. It is all about sleep paralysis. It is so interesting. Everybody go see it, go find it, go Google it right now, go watch it. It is really, really fantastic. Filmmaker Rodney Asher, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Come back and visit us anytime you like.
Right on. Thanks. It's great to talk with you.
Nice talking with you. All right. Have a lovely evening.
You too.
All right, we are going to take a break. We're going to get you to news, all that good stuff, and then turn things over to Dave Hoekstra. I'm sure he's got a very big show planned for you. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Okay, that does it for us on the Saturday night special. You know, as ever, we've picked this one big topic, and that tonight was sleep, and it seems so straightforward. You're either asleep or you're awake. But as we started to peel back the layers on this topic, you know, we started from a place of thinking, oh, we're not getting enough sleep. We got to take it so seriously. We got to hustle. We got to really, really get on it with the sleep. But then as we started to talk with our second guest, suddenly that shifted a little bit, and it was more of a, well, wait a minute, how are people everywhere else in the world sleeping? Let's not just think about what happens here in our country. Let's think about sleep habits around the world before we decide what is normal and required. And so that was a very interesting conversation. And then as we were talking with the filmmaker that we just spoke to about sleep paralysis and the documentary he made around that topic, very, very interesting topics and thoughts emerged on that, right? Because it seems like almost taboo to discuss something that's a little bit scary that our brains and bodies do in the middle of the night. And so we've talked about a lot of aspects of sleep that I find really, really interesting. So thank you for coming along on this conversation tonight. As ever, links to all the things mentioned and all of the people, you can read more about them on WGNradio.com once the podcast is posted, and we will see you back here next week.